Talk Chicago is now on the air. This is John Zaglua. I'll be your host for the next hour, and boy, do we have a lot to talk about today. Obviously, we're sifting through the wreckage that is last night's Bears game. We'll be talking about, too, Black Monday in the NFL. I know it happened a week ago, but last week we didn't have much to talk about. We were very busy on this show. I want to go back to that for a minute, analyze each team that has fired their head coach, and talk about why that happened and some possible candidates. And, of course, later in the show, we'll preview the College Football National Championship game. It's on tonight on Fox and ESPN, so it should be fun to watch that game as well. So lots to talk about today. So glad that you're here joining us on this Monday morning. Before we get started, let's take care of a little housekeeping. Remember, you're listening to 88.5 WHPK-FM Chicago. You can reach me personally on Twitter at John Z Sports, Instagram at John Zax, and Facebook at John Zaglua, or you can visit me at sportstalkchicago.com to listen to more podcasts and read more articles. All music that you hear on today's show is produced and performed by TMMRW. And he's on all music platforms, including Spotify and iTunes. Make sure to check him out if you like what you've heard. Now, if you want to contribute to today's conversations, and I'm sure you will based on what happened last night, give me a call, 773-702-8424. Again, that's 773-702-8424. We'll put you right on the air, and we can talk. So, obviously, we all know what I'm starting with today, and I want to start with this specifically. Before the 2018 Bears season began, there was a sense of optimism surrounding this team. Although my personal preseason prediction of an 8-8 record didn't necessarily correspond to that optimism, the point is, people felt good about this Bears team entering the year. And what's not to like? I mean, you're bringing in an offensive guru, someone coming from the Andy Reid coaching tree, someone who helped revitalize Alex Smith's career in Kansas City. You finally decided to spend some money by signing weapons like Allen Robinson, Taylor Gabriel, Trey Burton, another. And oh yeah, let's not forget about the blockbuster trade sending the best defender in the NFL to this team. The Bears were finally ready to win again. After 8 years of despair and mediocrity, bad head coaches, bad moves on the organization's part, it was time to start a new chapter in Bears history. And even though the season ended the way it did last night, the team did succeed in their goals, and let's not forget about that for a minute. A 12-4 season for the Bears, nobody could have predicted before this year began. There's a lot to be proud of, there's a lot to be happy about in regards to the 2018 Bears season. And of course, we'll get to what ended up happening in a minute, but just think about that for a minute. There's a lot to be proud of in regards to this Bears team. They did start a new chapter. They have regained their identity as the Monsters of the Midway. Progress is being made. Let's not forget that. But here's the thing. During that same offseason, when they got guys like Burton, Robinson, Gabriel, after watching Connor Barth kick field goals at a league-worst 69% conversion rate last year, did Ryan Pace and company ever think about the importance of having a reliable kicker? Did they ever think that, believe it or not, kicking is a crucial part of the game, and it can win and lose you football games? I'll bet that them, and as well as most of you, didn't care or didn't realize how important kicking was. Ryan Pace thought, hey, let's make the flashy move instead and acquire Khalil Mack. Let's commit all this money to three offensive weapons. Let's not worry about someone having to kick a football 40 yards through the uprights. Not a big deal. And look, I'm not trying to criticize the moves that were made. Of course I'm happy that Khalil Mack did well. And of course I'm satisfied with the offensive weapons given to Mitchell Trubisky. Because I'll tell you what, if those moves weren't made, say goodbye to the Bears even thinking about making the playoffs this year. Trey Burton, Allen Robinson, Taylor Gabriel, Khalil Mack all played key roles in having this team go back to the playoffs. That's without question. So I don't want to sit here and give you the wrong impression. Those moves should be celebrated. But what I'm not happy about is the Bears and Ryan Pace deciding to overlook the importance of kicking, and instead of looking at options like Sebastian Janikowski, Adam Vinatieri, even Matt Bryan, they decided to throw $15 million at a kicker who can't even make the simplest of field goals. And just for reference, after the game last night, I went online and looked at free agent kickers entering this season. And how ironic is this? CBS Sports created an article back in February about a loaded class of kickers in free agency. Adam Vinatieri, Matt Bryant, Janikowski, Graham Gano, Caleb Sturgis, Ryan Succop, Mike Nugent, Chandler Catanzaro, Cairo Santos, Nick Novak, and Kai Forbath, all of whom were free agent kickers that the Bears could have signed this offseason. All of those guys were on the market. Vinatieri, one of the greatest kickers of all time. Janikowski, one of the greatest kickers from 50 yards plus of all time. Those guys were out there, believe it or not. Yet for some reason, Cody Parkey's the guy who gets paid $15 million. Cody Parkey's the guy whom the Bears have to rely their hopes and dreams on. And Cody Parkey's the guy who missed last night's field goal. But why am I surprised? I mean, since Ryan Pace took over, all he's done is this. Run Robbie Gould out of town, sign Connor Barth, cut Mike Nugent and Cairo Santos, and yes, give Cody Parkey a contract. Ryan Pace did that. And again, you might not think this is important. You might not see the significance in this, especially considering all of the other moves that the Bears have made. But obviously, after watching last night's game, some questions have to be asked. So before I even get to Parkey and his missed kick, shame on Ryan Pace and the Bears management for not only failing to judge kicking talent, i.e. getting rid of Robbie Gould, signing Connor Barth to a contract, but for continuing to validate Parkey's performance by opting not to cut him, over the course of this season. Parkey missed 4 field goals in one game. This year, he's kicked around 74%, and the Bears decided, you know what, we're going to stick with him. That's a good idea. Now, on to the moment in which the Bears' season ended. My question is this, a couple of questions. How do you make a 43-yard field goal originally, then have it taken off the board due to a timeout, then completely miss it just over a minute later? And secondly, how do you convert on 3 separate occasions throughout the game, but miss it when it really counts in the end? I, personally, have no explanation for these questions. The Bears played well. Even though they lost last night's game, they played well overall. Sure, their passing defense had some holes, but I'll tell you what, they forced Nick Foles to throw 2 interceptions. For a guy who's riding high for a Super Bowl MVP, a reigning Super Bowl champion, I think it's impressive that the Bears picked him off twice in that game. And sure, Jordan Howard, he only rushed for 35 yards. But that itself nearly matched the total rushing yards that Philadelphia put up. I talked about on last week's show how Philadelphia does not have a run game. And overall in the season, they're averaging 3.9 yards per carry amongst 5 different running backs. And last night, the Bears swallowed them up every time they tried to run the football. The Bears contained their run game. The Bears forced 2 turnovers out of Nick Foles. So why didn't they win this game? Mitchell Trubisky played exceptionally well. Let's talk about him. 303 passing yards, 1 touchdown, 0 turnovers. For his first playoff game in his career, the biggest stage of his life, Mitchell Trubisky stepped up. That's impressive. And I know in the past I've been critical of him on this show, and I have been doubting him. I don't know if he's the next big thing for this Bears team. But in his first ever playoff game, one in which he was going up against the reigning Super Bowl champions, Mitchell Trubisky showed to me and shown to all of Chicago that he has the potential to be this franchise quarterback. And actually, after last night's performance, I'm more confident in him than ever. He set a record for the Bears in regards to throwing for the most passing yards in a quarterback's first career playoff game. He set a record, a franchise record for the Bears. No turnovers, there were no picks, no fumbles. Never coughed the ball up, threw for a touchdown pass, 300 passing yards. What's not to like about what Trubisky did last night? And keep in mind, I don't know the extent of what happened, but he was playing while hurt. I mean, there was a time last night where I thought Chase Daniel was going to have to come into the game because we all saw Trubisky limp gingerly off the field after he ran out of bounds early on. I think we all thought that Trubisky would have to leave the game, but he didn't. And by the way, that right there, if anyone had any doubts, makes him better automatically than Jay Cutler. There's so much parity in the NFL. I mean, remember 2010 NFC Championship game. Cutler gets hurt, doesn't return, and the Bears' hopes and dreams fall on Caleb Haney. And the day after, everybody criticized Cutler for being too soft and not coming back into the game. Trubisky last night, early on, got hurt. It was visible to everyone. But you know what? He stuck with it, stayed in the game, and performed exceptionally well. Right there, in my eyes, that makes Mitchell Trubisky a way better choice at quarterback than Jay Cutler. And it also shows off his grit, his determination, his toughness. All of that outnumbers Jay Cutler because of what happened last night. So that was impressive. The Bears played an all-around great game, and I don't have any complaints with the way they played. As I mentioned, I'm impressed with how they handled themselves against Nick Foles and the Super Bowl champs. What I don't understand, however, and what I'll probably never understand, though, is why Cody Parkey is still on this team and why the game was put on his shoulders. Parkey, in my eyes, is the most unreliable kicker in the National Football League. So again, I'm having trouble understanding why the game ended up depending on him. How can you miss a 43-yard field goal? I would understand if it's 50 yards further away. If the Bears had no choice and it was a 58-yard field goal, or they lose the game and Parkey missed it, I would understand. But 43 yards is essentially a chip shot. If you want to be a kicker in the NFL, you have to make a 43-yard field goal. End of story. That's it. And I know I'm completely overshadowing the controversial incompletion call involving Anthony Miller, which, by the way, that was a catch and a fumble. It wasn't incomplete. He took three steps. Horrible call by the referees. And I don't know if it was just me, but the referees did not call their best game last night. Seemed like there were far too many penalties called against the Bears, especially in regards to pass interference and defensive holding downfield. But that play involving Miller, that was a blown call on the referee. That should have been a completed catch, then a fumble. The Bears could have recovered it. They'd be at their own 3-yard line first and goal. Maybe they score a touchdown, and maybe Cody Parkey isn't the GOAT. Maybe things change. But look, that play means nothing in the context of how last night's game ended. Everybody has forgotten about that play now that Cody Parkey has missed the field goal. And this is oddly reminiscent, last night's game and the result, of the Vikings and Seahawks playoff game a few years ago, when Blair Walsh only needed to make a 21-yard field goal to win the game for the Vikings. Only 21 yards, and he flat out missed it. He shanked it. And since then, by the way, he's never recovered. He's been out of the NFL for 2 years, and my guess is that he'll never return. And now, Cody Parkey is in that same company. Judging by how passionate Chicago sports fans are, my guess is he'll never wear a Bears uniform again. And secondly, and I mean this sincerely, and this isn't a negative connotation, this is a sincere connotation, he needs to leave town. When Steve Bartman reached for the foul ball in 2003, he was getting death threats. That's how passionate Chicago sports fans are. And that's not okay. I don't condone that at all. You know what? In the end, this is just a game. Cody Parkey missed a field goal. I understand it's not good. I understand how enraged people are. But this is just an innocent person. A guy who has a family. This is someone who shouldn't be receiving death threats or should be getting threatened by Chicago sports fans. So Cody Parkey, though, I feel like he needs to be careful. Because I'm telling you right now, Chicago sports fans are passionate about their teams, and when something goes wrong, they feel that consequences need to be paid. So Cody Parkey, I hope he's careful around town, because what he did last night is something that's very hard to live down. But I have to say this, what a disappointing end to an otherwise surprising season. If only Ryan Pace had decided that kicking was important, and if only Cody Parkey could understand how to make a chip shot, we wouldn't be having this conversation. But it did happen. It did happen last night. And now we have to wait at least one more year before the Bears can make it back to the Super Bowl, and heck, before the Bears could advance past the wild card weekend. But what a disappointing ending, what a shocking and disappointing ending to an otherwise great and surprising season for the Chicago Bears. Hopefully they can replicate their success come next year, and I'm looking forward to seeing what they do in 2019. Folks, did you know that every day children are sexually solicited online? Don't believe the type. Visit cybertipline.com for information on how to protect yourself from the threat of online predators. So we just finished up talking about the Bears and their extremely disappointing ending to last night's game. If you have any thoughts on it, feel free to give me a call, 773-702-8424. Again, that's 773-702-8424. So let's stick with the NFL, and let's go from teams in the playoffs to teams out of the playoffs. Teams that had no chance of making the playoffs in the first place. Teams that had rosters, and more specifically, head coaches that just needed to go. Following the conclusion of the NFL season last Monday, six head coaches, all of which failed to take their respective teams to the playoffs, and all of which led their teams to losing records, were fired. And when adding the fact that Hugh Jackson and Mike McCarthy were fired mid-season, that means that there are now eight head coaching vacancies in the NFL after Black Monday. Now at this point, there have been lots of discussions over who will fill these positions. Heck, even some coaches who have just gotten fired are now candidates for other teams' jobs. So in this next segment, I'm going to go over each team's firing, why it happened, while at the same time propose some logical replacement candidates. You may not agree with what I say, you may have different thoughts and ideas, and that's fine. I'll tell you what, I spent way too much time doing this. I worked on this really hard, so I'd like to hear your opinions. Give me a call if you agree or disagree with what I say, 773-702-8424. We can work it out right here on the air. But let's start with the Miami Dolphins. Here's an interesting stat. I found this out via CBS Sports the day after the season ended. The Dolphins are the only team in the NFL to have a record between 6-10 and 10-6 in each of the last 10 seasons. So yes, the Dolphins have always been in the middle of the pack. They have made some playoff appearances with their constant 9-7 or 10-6 records. They have, but they haven't gone very far once they've made it. And at the same time, their continuous 6-10 wins per season largely come against divisional rivals like Buffalo, New York, and of course even New England. Can't forget about that lateral type ending earlier this year. But I mean, come on. When you have four games on your schedule dedicated to the Buffalo Bills and New York Jets, you're bound to win at least three, if not four, of those games. So then what's the problem here? Why have the Dolphins continually underachieved, and how can this be fixed? Well, Miami went about it by firing their head coach and former Chicago Bears offensive coordinator, Adam Gase. Gase went 23-25 in three seasons as the Dolphins head coach. Look, this may be an unpopular opinion, but I don't think this was necessarily Gase's fault. I mean, look at his quarterback situation throughout his tenure. He's had Ryan Tannehill, who would not be a starting quarterback on any other team except the Dolphins currently, plus Jay Cutler, who we all know is a train wreck, simply put. In Gase's case, don't blame him. Blame the front office for not allowing him to select his own quarterback in the draft, or at least sign a free agent. But they didn't let him. And instead of giving Gase the chance to have his own quarterback, he's now unemployed. For the Dolphins, however, don't worry about a head coach because all of the candidates will look the same at this point. Instead, worry about a quarterback. Get rid of Ryan Tannehill and either tank next season to get a high draft pick or look at someone in the draft this April or sign someone via free agency. Because the coach is not the problem. Ryan Tannehill is. Next up, the Arizona Cardinals. I feel bad for Steve Wilks, who lasted just 1 year in Arizona and produced a league-worst 3-13 record. But again, I feel that this was not necessarily his fault. Or at least the blame should not fully be placed on Wilks. Look at the hand that he was dealt. He had an injury-riddled David Johnson, who was completely dropped off from his former glory. He had a 35-year-old number one wide receiver in Larry Fitzgerald and no one else, and that's not to take away anything. Fitzgerald is a Hall of Fame receiver, but when your one offensive weapon is 35 years old, there's a problem. He then was given, most arguably, in my opinion, the worst rookie quarterback of last year's draft class in Josh Rosen. That all explains why the Cardinals' offense was ranked last in the NFL in almost every major category. So again, is that Wilks' fault for being given that situation, or is that management's fault for providing Wilks with nothing, the bare minimum in fact? Wilks is known throughout the league as a defensive guru. Heck, when I had Charles Tillman on my podcast back in August, before the season began, he cheered Wilks on, saying he was the right man for the job. Maybe he won't receive a head coaching job, and I understand, but Wilks should land somewhere as a defensive coordinator. And as for the Cardinals, similar to the Dolphins, you need weapons before you need a coach. Because the next guy who inherits the situation that Wilks had will probably also be fired sooner rather than later. Let's stay in the South now, talk about the Buccaneers and their firing of Dirk Koetter. Now, I will say this, under Koetter, Tampa Bay posted one of the worst defenses in the league. I mean, if you let Mitchell Trubisky throw 6 touchdown passes against you, then you've got major problems on defense. And Koetter also had to deal with the quarterback controversy, featuring the likes of Ryan Fitzpatrick and Jameis Winston, two mediocre players captaining a ship of constant losing and despair. But for a coach who has turned in back-to-back 5-11 seasons after going 9-7 to start his tenure, I think Tampa Bay made a smart and wise choice. Again, though, I should point out that Koetter didn't have a quarterback, nor an effective running game. But watching that defense play, especially in their game against the Bears, definitely justified that firing. Tampa Bay needs a quarterback-savvy coach to help mentor Jameis Winston and keep his head on the field and not have problems off the field. I wouldn't be surprised if Adam Gase stays in Florida and takes that job. Also, look for Bruce Arians, former Cardinals coach, to draw interest. This is my NFL Black Monday analysis, the 4th team on my list, the Denver Broncos. Vance Joseph, he made history in Denver, leading the team to back-to-back losing seasons for the first time since 1971 and 1972, over 40 years ago. That, in and of itself, completely justifies his firing. How can you inherit a team that at the time was 2 years removed from a Super Bowl and a year removed from a 9-7 record under Gary Kubiak to 2 straight 10 or more loss seasons? That right there, that fact explains everything. Vance Joseph is not an NFL head coach. He's a good defensive coordinator and a defensive mind, but he's not a head coach. End of story. As for possible replacement candidates, Bruce Arians is reportedly interested. Vic Fangio, current Bears defensive coordinator, also interesting because he would work wonders with that defense, which still has Von Miller and Bradley Chubb. But either way, the Broncos made a good decision by firing Joseph. He did nothing for this organization but make history, of course, for all of the wrong reasons. Next on the list is the New York Jets. The Jets this year went 4-12 with a rookie quarterback that has shown potential, an average running game, and 2 average wide receivers. Offensively, I'll admit they didn't have much. But Todd Bowles is a defensive mind, a former defensive coordinator. Despite his so-called expertise, the Jets finished 25th in the league in total defense, 25th. So much for being a defensive guru. Bulls led the Jets to a 10-6 season in his first year at the helm, and things have gone dramatically downhill ever since. His firing, in my eyes, is justified. I don't care about the offense because that's not necessarily his fault. He's not an offensive mind, and he didn't have many weapons. But when you can't live up to your namesake as a defensive mind, then you've got a problem. The Jets, like the Cardinals and Buccaneers, need someone to help lead Sam Darnold in what will be his sophomore season coming up next year. Look for Adam Gase and college coach Lincoln Riley to take over in New York. And the final team that we'll talk about today on this Black Monday analysis is the Cincinnati Bengals and the firing of Marvin Lewis. Wow, I can't believe that I actually lived to see the day that Marvin Lewis had gotten a pink slip in his office. Now the question is this the end of an era in Cincy? Some people say yes, others say no. I say of course it is. Lewis had been a fixture on this team, and in the era for 16 years. That itself is impressive, and I applaud Lewis on lasting that long. Now realistically, I think we all have an idea as to why Lewis was fired. This past season, the Bengals didn't only rank last in the league in total defense, but their numbers were at an all-time high. Case in point, no defense in NFL history has ever allowed three consecutive 500-yard games until the Bengals in 2018. But that's not even the major problem. Lewis, in seven playoff games, has never won one. He is 0-7 in his career in the playoffs. And to add to that, he hasn't led the Bengals to a winning season or a playoff appearance or even a .500 season since 2015. So again, happy trails to Marvin Lewis, and I hope that he can land a job as a defensive coordinator or possibly even another head coaching gig. He is a good coach. He's been around for a long time. He's had success at one point in Cincinnati. But I think that it was time for a change. As for replacements, it has been reported that the Bengals' job is considered the worst head coaching vacancy available. Right now, though, it's looking like it'll be Hugh Jackson or Zach Taylor, the current Rams quarterback coach. What I will say is this. Hiring Hugh Jackson would be a worse move than firing Marvin Lewis. So I hope the Bengals think through that decision before making one that they'll end up regretting. That was my NFL Black Monday update, and those are my opinions on each of the coaching vacancies that occurred on Black Monday. When you're driving around the block or up on the street, you don't need to wear a seatbelt because you know nothing's going to go wrong if you're in a car crash, right? Wrong. Because anybody who's ever been in a car crash can tell you they never saw it coming. So always buckle up, always. So we just finished up talking about Black Monday. We talked about the Bears earlier and their disappointing end to the season. And at this time, we'll be playing my interview. It's the Sports Talk Chicago Flashback with Chuck Garfine, a host and anchor on NBC Sports Chicago. We discussed his thoughts on the White Sox, their pursuit of Bryce Harper and Manny Machado. We analyzed the Chicago Cubs and their quiet offseason thus far. Later in the interview, he talks about his road to where he is today, and he talks about some great stories that he's had of covering Chicago sports over the past 20 years. So we'll play the interview, come back, we have the call of the day, and a national championship preview to come. You're listening to Sports Talk Chicago right here on 88.5 WHPK-FM Chicago. Today, Chuck, let's address the elephant in the room involving the White Sox and their pursuit of Bryce Harper and Manny Machado. Now, they've sent some mixed signals because they are interested in Harper, but at the same time, they've recently acquired Yonder Alonso, Machado's brother-in-law, not to mention the fact that they had Machado in on some touring around Guaranteed Rate Field. What are you expecting the White Sox to do in this situation?
It looks like they're trying to do everything they can to sign one of them, at least. I don't think they have room for both of them, but you know, you got to pursue both. I mean, they both fit what the White Sox are trying to do long term. The fact that they're 26 and the prime is of their careers, and they, I know they kind of hate me to say this, but they check all the boxes for the White Sox. So it makes sense for them to, you know, you got to pursue both and see where, see if you can sign one of them. And it's a big poker game going on between the players, the agents, the teams. So we'll see what happens. It looks to me like the White Sox are doing everything in their power to try to sign one of them. You can only do so much, and there's some big competitors that they have to deal with, meaning, you know, the Yankees, the Phillies, possibly the Dodgers for Bryce Harper. So despite, you know, you could put forth the most money. We're assuming whoever offers the most money is going to get them, but you never know. We're all just kind of speculating, and that's what this whole game is right now, a game of speculation. So I think you, me, and everyone listening has to kind of sit back and try to be patient in this situation. I know it's tough because there's so much at stake. These are two franchise players, franchise-altering players, and if the White Sox are able to get one of them, I mean, my goodness, it'll be a major, major, like, cosmic shift here in Chicago and in the American League Central, that's for sure.
I know you mentioned one of them or one or the other, but do you actually see it being a possibility for the Sox to sign both Harper and Machado? Is that a legitimate possibility, or is that something that's going to be very difficult knowing the other contenders that are in play for both guys?
I mean, it's extremely difficult because you're asking, you're basically putting, you know, I don't know what they're, again, everyone is speculating what they're both going to get. And who knows what's really going on behind the scenes. I'm assuming it's going to be a $30 million a year player for both. Would the Sox spend $60 million plus on two players? I don't think so. But I guess my point is, I don't want to assume anything. I just don't want to assume anything. So it sounds crazy to do that, but who knows? I would, if, you know, I'm guessing that they're not going to try to sign both, but you never know. But so don't put me on it. I'm thinking they're trying to get one of these guys, and if they do get one of them, that would be incredible.
So let's say the Sox end up signing either player. Now, in any case, they're still a year or two away from contention. So what will a signing like this do to that initial timeline? I mean, could we be seeing the Sox making the playoffs or at least contending for a playoff spot next season with Harper and or Machado in their lineup?
Yeah, I think we let's not get ahead of ourselves. It's step by step by step. And if the White Sox are able to sign one of these guys, then great, then we can have that conversation. And I don't think that on the surface getting one of these guys is going to make them contenders. They just because they're just so young. That being said, baseball is a funny game, and players develop at different stages. So, you know, if Moncada ends up having a big year, and Lopez and Giolito and all these guys, Tim Anderson, all take steps forward collectively, you couple that with, you know, the Indians potentially taking a step back, then, yeah, maybe they can contend. But, you know, I know all of us want to jump into that conversation about, oh, can they contend in 2019 if this happens and if this happens? You know, I'm just focused on can they potentially get one of these guys. That would be great. And then if they do, then we can have that next conversation of what could the White Sox do in 2019.
And, you know, with you being a White Sox reporter, being so close to the team, what are you hearing about the team's financial state? Because in the past, this is an organization that historically does not like to spend too much money. But this year, that's obviously changed. Why do you think that is?
Well, I mean, they have spent a lot of money in the past. You might remember it was 2011, I think. They signed Adam Dunn. They brought back, I think it was Canerco and AJ, if I'm not mistaken. And, you know, Kenny Williams famously said, we're all in. And they spent a lot of money, and the payroll was high. And then there was the year, like, I think, winter of 2013 or 14, where they, you know, signed Melky Cabrera and David Robertson. They traded for Jeff Samardzija and forgetting someone there, and they were really active that offseason as well. Now, there's a difference between doing that and then, you know, signing a player for $300 million. But, you know, the White Sox kind of pick and choose their moments as to when they're going to be aggressive and when they want to dial it back. And, you know, they dialed it back for a few years, and by doing that, gave them the opportunity to, you know, flex their financial might. And that's what they're doing now. I mean, how many teams are, you know, in the conversation for Machado and Harper? Very few, because it's a whole lot of money. And the White Sox have been planning for this for years, ever since, you know, 2 years ago when they embarked on this rebuild. This was their first big window of opportunity to spend because they saw that these two prime free agents were going to potentially be available. You didn't know for certain. They could have always, you know, re-upped with their teams and not gone to free agency, but the hope was that they'd be available, and here they are, and they're trying to take advantage of the moment.
Chuck Garfine here on Sports Talk Chicago. And Chuck, I want to shift to the Bulls and now the end of the second week in the Jim Boylan era. Now, according to many reports, it hasn't been a smooth transition. Players seem to have already lost confidence in the team itself. What are your thoughts on Fred Hoiberg's firing and how Boylan has handled the team so far, stepping in and becoming the permanent head coach?
You know, it's been messy. You know, I would be lying if I said it was smooth sailing. There were some growing pains there. He's trying to, you know, step into a role and be the kind of head coach that he wants to be, and he's, you know, trying to shake things up with his team that is proving to be a problem so far. It's a young team. They're rebuilding. Everyone's trying to kind of find their roles, and there are some growing pains there, no doubt. It stinks that not everyone, you know, it stinks that they've had these injuries, and LaVine and Markkanen and Dunn can't play together, and that's a big part of your future. That being said, more losses, more chances to get a number one or number two pick next year. So that's just kind of where things are at right now with the Bulls. You want to see some growth with their players. And, you know, Boylan, you know, this is his first head coaching job in the NBA, and he's, you know, trying to leave an impact to these guys and affect them positively. And as we sit here right now, it's been messy, but, you know, sometimes that happens. And so let's kind of see if these guys can find their footing over the next few weeks and get this thing going in a positive direction. Right now, it's just, as I said, I think messy is the best way to describe the last few weeks with the Bulls.
And it's interesting, you know, you mentioned the injuries to Portis and Markkanen and without Dunn, and Fred Hoiberg had to kind of right that ship in a way during the beginning of the season. Now, I'm not saying that Hoiberg was necessarily the best coach for the job, but do you feel that his firing was unfair knowing what he had to go through?
You know, I think there's more to the story than just, you know, he didn't have players. You can definitely make the argument that, yes, it did not help him that he did not have his full complement of players to do what he did. But I think there's more to the story than just that. I would kind of lean on the guys who cover the team consistently. I'm not covering it right now. Or, you know, I haven't been on the beat in a couple seasons. But I'll just leave it at there's more to the story than just that.
And now under Jim Boylan, the Bulls are ready to trade Jabari Parker less than a year after the $40 million contract and the two-year deal. Why is Parker getting moved so quickly, and what have been your thoughts on his performance so far this year?
You know, I think he kind of got caught up in this coaching change and, you know, in a more up-tempo, run-and-gun kind of offense that Hoiberg is running. I think Parker fit that. From where I sit, it looks like Boylan wants to have a more defensive mindset, and at last check, Jabari Parker's defense has not exactly been, you know, all-star caliber, and I think that's where a problem comes for Parker with Boylan running the show and why it might make sense to trade him and see what you can get for him.
Now, I want to ask you from a personal standpoint, after witnessing what has gone on with this team for the past couple of weeks, what's in store for this Bulls franchise? What do you expect to come out of all of this dysfunction in the future?
You're a good player next season in the draft. That's how I look at it. You know, it's tough to predict how it's all going to go. But what I will say is, you know, in the NBA, if there is a sport where one player can make a massive impact on a team and a franchise, it's basketball. You know, in baseball, you could, you know, have the best player in the game. You get the best player in the last 30 years. But when the game is on the line, if the order does not work in your team's favor, and that player may not be able to come to the plate in the bottom of the ninth when the game's on the line. In basketball, you can give the ball always to your best player. He can affect change. And so, and there's only, you know, 10 players on the court. So, you know, they need some luck. They need some fortune. It's been a lot of misfortune lately. And, you know, when they got Derrick Rose, it was pure luck that they were able to draft him. They need And they've been able to get some pieces together, and I think, you know, in time, if they get some real fortune in the NBA draft, I like Wendell Carter Jr., but, you know, you get a number one, number two player who can really change things, the course of your franchise. I think that if you throw all that together, you can really quickly turn it around. That's the optimist in me, and I'm hoping that happens with the Bulls in the near future.
Moving to your personal career, I know that you grew up right here in the Chicago area and even started hosting your own radio show in high school. Take me through your stops along the way and how you ended up being such a well-known figure here in Chicago sports media.
Oh, that's a tough one right there. Okay, so I did start out in high school when I was like yourself. I mean, you started really early. You were 13 when you started this venture. You started doing podcasts, right? 13?
Correct.
All right, so when I was 14, as a freshman in high school, I went to Holman Fossmont High School, and they have a high school radio station. And I started DJing, and I would do little sports casts from time to time, and I would announce play-by-play for, like, the JV basketball team and football team. And then, as time went on, I did more things at the high school. I became the station manager my senior year, so I was really got a lot of experience in high school. And then after college, I got my first job in Traverse City, Michigan. You mentioned that. That was the NBC affiliate in Traverse City. I was there for a year and a half. I mean, there were a lot of stops along the way. ESPN, I was there for the start of ESPN News when I was 25. I got a great break to do that, and that was a huge adjustment for me because I had gone from doing 3.5-minute sportscasts a night in Traverse City to host solo anchoring a 3-hour show 5 days a week. And that was a big challenge, but a great experience for me to learn how all the ins and outs of anchoring and getting through, you name it, from, you know, technical problems to, you know, announcing highlights blindly on the air live, you know, you name it. And that was just an incredible experience for me. You know, from there, I was in markets like Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and Detroit, Michigan, and New York, and Denver. And then in 2004, you know, I got this break to come to Chicago and start at Comcast Sportsnet. And the first year we were on the air, I was covering the White Sox, and they won the World Series. So it was great, great timing, and quite a joyride that I got to be on in our first year here, and I've been covering the White Sox ever since. And that's a basic, you know, 3-minute answer about my career. We can go a little bit more in depth if you'd like, if you have any questions, but that's basically the cliff notes of what I've done in the last, believe it or not, if I count high school, boy, I've been doing it for, okay, you know what, I'm not going to go there. That's way too long. Oh my goodness. Over 30 years. Over 30 years I've been doing this. That's crazy.
Does it feel like it's been 30 years to you?
No, it's just like 30 weeks, 30 days. Like, it just started. I feel like I was back in Holman Fossmont announcing Holman Fossmont Viking basketball for the first time. It feels like that was last week. It's crazy.
How fulfilling is it for you? I know you mentioned your time with the White Sox and how you've been a fan since you grew up in this area. How fulfilling has it been for you then to cover them so in depth as well over this past decade?
Yeah, if you would have told the 10-year-old version of myself that I would be for a job covering the Chicago White Sox, I would not believe you. It is a dream come true. I remember for at least the first 6 or 7 years, I was like kind of pinching myself that I was actually able to do this for a living. You know, I just grew up a humongous Chicago sports fan, loved the White Sox. I did not hate the Cubs, I'll just be honest with you. I did like to watch the Cubs and go to Wrigley Field. I still like going to Wrigley Field. But I was a White Sox fan. And so it's been incredible. And, you know, what helps is, you know, even though I worked in all these other markets, I didn't have the history, you know, that of those towns. I mean, you can learn it and learn it, but I didn't live it. I lived being a Chicago sports fan. And so, you know, I have conversations with Rick Hahn a lot because Rick was a lot like me. We're about the same age, and he was a diehard Chicago sports fan and just obsessed with it. And so we kind of share a lot of the same memories of growing up here in Chicago and living and dying with the teams. And so it's a special city, and I'm so lucky and fortunate that I get to do this for a living.
That was my interview there with Chuck Garfine on my Sports Talk Chicago flashback. Really great insights on the Bulls and the White Sox, and also some great stories about his career, how he got started. He's Chicago born and raised, so really nice to have him on today's show and our Sports Talk Chicago flashback. Right now, it's now time for our signature segment here on Sports Talk Chicago called the Announcer's Call of the Day. Last night, the Bears were just one field goal away from winning their first playoff game in 8 years and advancing to the NFC divisional round. Unfortunately, things didn't go exactly as planned. Let's listen into Al Michaels and Chris Collinsworth on the call for NBC Sports as Cody Parkey ends the Bears' season.
3-yard attempt from the right hash mark. It's impossible. And the Eagles run out into the field, but there's still 5 seconds. So they've got to get back. He does it again.
When you brought back to the spot of the kick, it will be Philadelphia.
Did this hit
ball.
The first upright the and the crossbar?
Bottom line, it doesn't go through. Upright. It looks like it bounced off the crossbar as well.
There you have it. There's the call from Al Michaels, Chris Collinsworth, NBC Sports on the game last night. Again, I cannot say how disappointing that finish was for the Bears fans. Hopefully they can come back next year very strong. But for these last 10, 15 minutes here, I want to talk about tonight. Tonight is a big night for any college football fan, because after an unimpressive semifinal round, the college football national championship is set as the number one ranked Alabama Crimson Tide take on the number two ranked Clemson Tigers. So for this next segment, we're going to talk about both teams' strengths, weaknesses. Then in the end, I'll pick a winner and a final score to correspond with the point spread. Now, before I give a definite prediction on the winner, let's analyze both teams, okay? The Tigers are currently 14-0. They completely obliterated Notre Dame in the Cotton Bowl on December 30th. And that's been the story for much of the season for Clemson, as they've won 12 of their 14 games by more than one possession. They aren't in many close games, lots of barn burners instead. That offensive attack, which ranks third in the nation overall, is led by their running back, Travis Etienne. Etienne is averaging an amazing 8.3 yards per carry, rushing for over 1,500 yards, 22 rushing touchdowns. He is a major key for this team on offense. Quarterback Trevor Lawrence has also performed well, coming in early in the year, replacing the former starter, 27 touchdowns, 4 picks to his name, passer rating over 150. As good as their offense is, Clemson's defense is even better. They rank second in the nation. Clelin Ferrell recording 11.5 sacks. Isaiah Simmons, 46 tackles. This defense as a team gives up only 12.9 points per game on average, which is the best in the NCAA. Now, as for Alabama, the Crimson Tide also sit at 14-0. They beat Oklahoma in the Orange Bowl by a score of 45-34. And I understand that score is kind of close, but the game wasn't. Couple of those touchdowns for Oklahoma were scored in garbage time via Kyler Murray. And in a similar sense to Clemson, Alabama has won 13 of their 14 games by more than one possession. Alabama's offense is led by their starting quarterback and Heisman Trophy finalist Tua Tagovailoa. Tua has thrown for 41 touchdowns against just 4 interceptions. His passer rating is over 200. And speaking of Tua, a lot of people talked about the Heisman Trophy, how he should have won it. He did have a great year. My opinion, though, and maybe this is unpopular, I feel like Kyler Murray is the right choice. Murray threw for more touchdown passes, had a better touchdown-interception ratio, a better rating, more passing yards, a better completion percentage, more rushing yards. Tua did great, and that's fine, and I don't doubt that one bit. But when you're statistically better in all of those categories, and thinking about the fact that Jalen Hurts had to come in and bail out Tua in the last game of the season, the regular season, meanwhile Kyler Murray led Oklahoma single-handedly to the record that they had, I feel that Tua was not the favorite and should not have won that Heisman Trophy. So just going off there on a tangent for a minute, because I know that that's been also a highly contested, a highly debated topic. Kyler Murray is the deserving winner of the Heisman Trophy. Tua is not. If you have any thoughts on that, give me a call. We can talk about it. But I feel that still Kyler Murray was the right choice. And that's not to take anything away, though, from Tua's season. He's had a very good year. Additionally, the Crimson Tide have three different running backs, all of which average over 5 yards a carry, which is impressive. But there is a key question, though, something that I don't think has been addressed enough. Who is going to step up and make a considerable impact in this national championship? Who is Alabama going to rely on in the running game and for a running back? Because think about it. This is a school with a storied history at running back. Derrick Henry, Sean Alexander, Mark Ingram, Trent Richardson, T.J. Yeldon, have all made their mark on Crimson Tide history. And have all made their mark on NFL history. I mean, Sean Alexander, amazing running back. Derrick Henry right now, tearing it up for the Titans this year. He had a breakout season. Mark Ingram, very good. Trent Richardson, okay, I'll give you that, one of the bigger busts in NFL history. And T.J. Yeldon making an impact in limited carries on the Jaguars. All of those running backs, except for one, have worked wonders for Alabama, have come to the NFL, and have done great. Alabama is good at producing running backs, not good at quarterbacks, of course, if you look back at their past, but at running backs, that is their bread and butter. The running game is a big deal for Alabama. This is a major part of their identity, and right now, they have no clue as to who will be their legitimate starter tonight against Clemson. I mean, you look at who they've got. They've got three different guys with 100 or more rushing attempts. Damian Harris, Joshua Jacobs, Najee Harris. Damian Harris with the most rushing yards, per se, and the most carries. Najee Harris, less carries, nearly the same amount of yards. He's averaging more per carry. And then you've also got Brian Robinson Jr., who has 63 rushes himself as their number four running back. So it's too fluid, that position for Alabama right now. Will that come back to hurt them? I don't know. But I'll tell you what, I'd rather take Travis Etienne, who's averaging over 8 yards per carry and is the definitive starter for Clemson. That's all I'm saying. Defensively, Quinnen Williams has 18 sacks for Alabama. Isaiah Buggs, 13.5 sacks. They've led their defensive attack. Overall, however, the Crimson Tide ranked 13th in the country in total defense, which is a far cry from Clemson's second-place finish. This defense is good. It is top of the line. There's nothing wrong with being ranked 13th in the nation. That's impressive, but it doesn't necessarily compare to Clemson's. So keeping all of this in mind, knowing that Alabama has an edge at quarterback and has two excellent defensive players, while also knowing that Clemson dominates the run game and team defense, I expect a close-scoring game. I don't expect a shootout necessarily or a blowout. There will be points on the board, but I don't expect this to be game over in the second quarter, for example. This is going to go four quarters for sure. You're probably thinking, as we get to the picks now, that I'm going to pick Clemson to win this game, and I really, really want to. I want Clemson to win this, because I'm sick and tired of hearing about Alabama winning championship after championship. I mean, this is like the New England Patriots of college football. I'm sick and tired of hearing about it. But when making this pick, I can't ignore Alabama's dynastic run. I can't ignore the fact that Alabama has won 5 national titles since 2009. And I can't ignore the Crimson Tide's Heisman-worthy quarterback. Tua, whether you like it or not, I know he's not the winner, but he was a finalist and he was there for a reason. He had an impressive season, and it's going to keep going, I feel like, tonight. Therefore, when you keep all of this in mind, you know that the Tigers rank better statistically, but Alabama has that edge and that dynastic run. I'm going to pick Alabama to win the national championship. Right now, they're at a 5.5-point favorite, so it is going to be a close game, and I believe that they will cover the spread They will win 35-28. Alabama will win, again, 35-28 tonight, covering the 5.5-point spread. As I said, this will be a close game and a relatively high-scoring game. Even though Clemson has a great nationally ranked defense, I feel like that they're going to have some trouble stopping Tua. So anyways, although I want Clemson to win, and I hope they do, and they prove me wrong, I'm picking Alabama 35-28. Nick Saban will get another national championship. This will be his sixth, by the way, if he wins tonight, which I have to say is extremely impressive. I mean, kudos and hats off to him. Again, though, as if you're not an Alabama fan, if you're a fan of anyone else, you're sick and tired of hearing about them winning it all. So again, I want Clemson to win, but I don't think they will. And I feel like Alabama will end the year once again by being the number one team in the country. That's my pick for tonight's national championship game tonight at 7 o'clock. If you're a college football fan or not, I'm not necessarily. I really am not. I'm still going to watch this game because I feel like it's going to be electric. You've got two great teams going at it. You've got a Heisman Trophy finalist. You've got an amazing running back for Clemson. This will be a good game. So if you're not a Heisman, if you're not a college football fan and you want to take your mind off that Bears loss from last night, I highly suggest you throw on the national championship tonight because you'll be in for some very good football and a competitive football game itself. Well, that does it for us today here on Sports Talk Chicago. I hope you enjoyed today's show. Unfortunately, we had to come on despite the circumstances of last night's Bears game, but we did. We got through it. I aired my grievances. You guys got to listen, so it's all good now. We can put it behind us. Look forward to next year. Again, I'm John Zaglul, host here on Sports Talk Chicago. You can find me on Twitter at John Z Sports, Instagram at John Zags, Facebook and LinkedIn at John Zaglul. Also, make sure to tune into SportsTalkChicago.com for articles, podcasts, and more special interviews. This Friday, I'm having on Hall of Fame baseball player Ozzie Smith on my podcast. I'm really looking forward to that interview. I hope you join me on the website. Please remember to tune in next Monday and every Monday at 9 a.m. to get your latest Chicago sports fix. And at this time, I'd like to thank the University of Chicago contributor Chuck Garfine, WHBK, for today's show. We'll sign off with music by TMMRW. Thank you again for listening today, and so long, everyone.